Welcome to the Wealth Studying Podcast. I'm your host, John Pugliano. I'm also the founder and money manager of InvestableWealth.com. Today is October 1st, 2014. This is episode 33. The Wealth Studying Podcast and the Wealth Studying Lifestyle is all about teaching you and helping you to build wealth and personal freedom. Money may not buy happiness, but it can buy freedom. It all depends on how you use it. And that's why in this podcast, we focus on the 10 wealth-building principles, not only to help you increase your net worth, but to help you build a better life with more freedom and more personal responsibility. Speaking of the 10 wealth-building principles, if you're new to the show and you haven't heard them yet, go back to the first 10 episodes. That's where I lay out my philosophy and my concept of how to build wealth. Those first 10 episodes are there to educate you and to help you lay down a foundation. And then each follow-up show that I do somehow relates back to one or more of those 10 principles. We try and apply the news of the day, stock trading strategies, personal life experiences, just events of the day, which we try and review all these things in light of those 10 wealth-building principles. I can't guarantee that they'll work for you, but I developed those over nearly 30 years of my life experience, and they sure helped me get where I am today. So in this episode, I'm going to answer a listener question that asked if investing in the stock market was like gambling. I also want to give you a market review, just a real quick one. The markets are very unstable. Investors Business Daily today moved the market from uptrend under pressure to market incorrection, so I do want to comment on that. And I also want to give a quick review and update on some of the things I've said in recent episodes about the ability of people to save and accumulate a lot of money. Now, these are people that are just starting out in life, young adults with at or below average income. Just wanted to give you another comment and update on that. I've heard from some additional people. I want to pass that along to you. Now, let's talk about the stock market. As I said today, Investors Business Daily, they called the market in a correction. Now, that just means that there's a high likelihood that the market could continue its downfall. Now, when they talk about a correction, that doesn't mean the end of the world. That doesn't mean economic collapse. It doesn't even mean we're moving into a bear market. Their definition is something they use simply as a warning. To them, a correction could easily be the market dropping off of its highs by as much as 10% or more. Now, every time they say that the uptrend is under pressure or the market is in correction, that doesn't mean we're immediately going to have a 10% fall or anything like that. It's just an early warning sign. It's like when you're driving down the road and you come up on a traffic light and it starts flashing yellow. In the case of a traffic light, it's warning you to say, hey, the light's going to go to red, you're going to have to stop. Well, in the market, there's no certainty. We don't get those clear of messages. So we have to kind of read between the lines. We have to look at leading indicators, and people ultimately have to make a judgment call. And that's what Investors Business Daily did today by saying the market is in correction. They had it under pressure for, I guess about the last week or so. And in fact, for a good bit of this year, they've either had the market in correction or uptrend under pressure. Mostly it was an uptrend under pressure. This year, 2014, is very, very unusual. I don't remember any year when the market has gone up as much as it has and hit as many highs as it has, and at the same time climbed such a wall of worry. When a publication like Investors Business Daily has called so many uptrends under pressure, and yet people come in, buy on the dips, and the markets go on to all-time highs. We live in interesting times. Well, as far as Investors Business Daily signal that the market is in correction, if you follow my blog over at InvestableWealth.com, or if you've been listening to this podcast, none of this is going to come to any surprise to you. The sudden souring of the market's been blamed on everything from global weakness, you know, slowdown, maybe deflationary pressures in Europe, soft market in China. Today's news, they're even blaming things like maybe there's the Ebola scare in Texas, and possibly even Bill Gross stepping down from PIMCO. And now we're really stretching things. But the media will look for any excuse to justify why the market is either up or down. And you really can't blame them, because it's human nature. All of us want answers. So every day, people like me and you, we see the market fluctuate. It goes up 1%, it goes down 1%, whatever. We want to pick up a newspaper or log onto the internet, and we want answers. We want to know, well, why did it go up or why did it go down? Well, even when there's no logical reason for it, and most times there isn't, the media isn't going to disappoint you. They're not going to tell you, hey, nothing to see here. We have no idea why the market just dropped 1%. They're going to give you a story. They're going to give you a story because that's what you want. Sort of like the government. You know, you get the government you deserve. Well, you get the news stories that you deserve as well. And so, like I say, they're blaming this correction and this, you know, unstable market, definitely for the last week or so, on everything from, you know, from the global slowdowns, Federal Reserve raising interest rates, you know, tapering of QE3, as I mentioned, now the Ebola scare in Texas, Bill Gross stepping down from PIMCO. Who knows? I don't know if it's any of those things. Again, if you've been listening to me, you're not surprised. I've been very concerned because of what I have known about the global slowdown. It isn't like it just happened this week. It's something that's been building for a long time. The markets are very soft. We're seeing a lot of problems in countries all around the world. The U.S. economy is doing well, but that could be just a surface phenomena. There's a lot of structural weakness in our U.S. market. Yes, quantitative easing is supposedly being tapered down. This month is supposed to end it, but again, that's nothing new. This is something we've known for about a year, year and a half. More than anything, the market could have been dropping so much this past week and in today in particular, because we're at the start of a new quarter. The market fluctuates and reacts more to human nature and more to the interactions of humans than it does with any type of rationality or any type of predictability. And I bring that up in reference to the beginning of the fourth quarter, because this is strictly a human event. It's just a date on a calendar. But because of that, institutional investors, pension fund managers, hedge fund managers, they all have to report their numbers quarterly. So between yesterday and today, they had to make adjustments for what they were going to report for what they held in the third quarter, and now what they're going to be holding in the fourth quarter. A lot of times they call that window dressing. They want to make those reports reflect well on them. They want to look like they're the smartest guys in the room. So if something like Facebook is up, or GoPro, or Alibaba, some one of those kind of stocks, even if they didn't make any profits on it, even if they hadn't held it all quarter, they might want to buy it on the last day of the month, or last day of the quarter, or the beginning of the next quarter, just so that they can report that they hold it, that it's in their holdings. So then they can brag to people at cocktail parties and say what a genius they were for buying into Alibaba. When in fact, again, they may flip it as soon as they get it. Now, I'm not saying everybody does this. I'm not even saying most managers do this. I'm just saying it does happen. It is window dressing. Things like that and variations of it happen all the time. So that's why at the end of a month, or particularly at the end or the beginning of a quarter, there's always a lot of fluctuations. Same thing with taking profits. Now, these fund managers, they've known that the global economy has been very weak. They know that the U.S. market, the stock market, is either highly fairly priced or overpriced. Overbought at this point. They know that quantitative easing is coming to an end. Maybe interest rates are going to be rising, but they're controlling billions and billions of dollars. So they just can't sell immediately. They've got to get out of things. They've got to trickle out. And so while I think they have been doing that for the better part of this year, we are starting to get to the end of the year. And if these managers want to take a profit, then they're running out of time. As we move into fourth quarter, maybe they've been selling harder now so they can lock in these profits so they have good numbers to report at the end of the year. I've mentioned Bill Gross a couple times. Most people probably don't know who he is. It's a little bit of inside baseball, but anybody that's involved in investing in the financial markets from a professional basis, we know who Bill Gross is. He's widely quoted. For the most part, he has a stellar reputation, and a lot of people follow him. He's known as the Bond King. You see, he's presided over PIMCO for, I don't know, the last 40 years or something, 35 years, and he's made himself and that company and a lot of money investing in bonds. Primarily, I think, U.S. Treasury bonds, but also corporate bonds, sovereign debt bonds. As I say, he's made a lot of people a lot of money, and many, many people have listened to every word he's said and taken it for the gospel truth. Well, I just bring him up because I think it's funny that his name, like the Ebola scare, is one of these things that's possibly scaring the stock market this week. You see, he resigned from PIMCO, and he's going over to Janus. Now, the guy's 70 years old, and he's richer than King Solomon. So why he's retiring, resigning from the company that he founded and going over to manage a smaller fund at Janus doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I mean, if he just wants to stay in the game and invest, and even if he just wants to pump up his ego, well, he has so much money, just investing his own money would take all of his time. And since he's so well known and so well liked by the media, he could easily have a TV show, a radio show. You know, he currently does from time to time host his own podcast. So I think it's very odd that he's moving over to Janus. But his behavior, particularly his behavior in the last 6 months to a year, has been extremely odd, even odd for him. And he's kind of an oddball character anyways. Since Bill Gross is not necessarily a household name, I don't want to belabor it in this podcast. I do want to say that although I think there could be some shenanigans going on with him and what he did at PIMCO, one of his ETF funds is currently being investigated by the Securities and Exchange Commission. He has had extremely odd behavior. And I do think there's probably more to the story and more of that might come out. but I don't see how his resignation is what's throwing the stock market into turmoil, like some people are suggesting. Again, that's just to sell headlines. People are just saying those kind of things because they know it'll get attention and people will click on the advertisement or click on the article. If you do want to know more about Bill Gross, if there's enough interest from the listening audience, go ahead and get in touch with me. I'll do a segment or something on really who he is and why there's such a cult of personality around him. In fact, sometime in the future, I'll probably do an episode on the cult of personality. But if there is specific interest in Bill Gross, I will come back and we'll do a quick segment on one of these upcoming podcasts. Let me know. Otherwise, like I say, it might be too much inside baseball and I won't get into it. But rest assured, the market isn't falling on any one thing. Not today, anyways. There's a lot of problems in the world. We still have issues with Russia and Crimea and Russian sanctions, problems in the Middle East, way over capacity in a lot of products and services, everything from brick and mortar, the big old traditional retail regional malls, down to too much gasoline and petroleum refining. There's a lot of troubles, there's a lot of bubbles, there's way too much government and way too much private and public debt. It's all been papered over by these central banks for the last 6 years or so, between them and the governments flooding the market with deficit spending. Ultimately, that's why we see so many problems and so much turbulence under the surface. But for the last 3 years or so, they've been very good about papering things over. Investors are coming in and buying things up on the dips. Will this be any different? I have no way of knowing. Just watch. Just be careful. If you've never invested in the stock market before, this may not be the best time for you to jump in. Take your time. Use prudence. It might be a good idea to just let things settle down for a while. As to the performance of the stock market, all the major indexes are down. They've had a bad couple of days. Today was especially hard hit. The last week has been fairly gloomy. And this is everything from the blue chip stocks on the Dow Jones Industrial, the S&P 500, over to the higher tech stocks, more of the growth stocks on the NASDAQ, and then especially the small cap stocks on the Russell 2000. They've been hit hard all year. And again, been more magnified over the past few days. I have mentioned before, and we have seen, though, where it seemed like there was a rotation where these fund managers were getting out of the riskier stocks beginning this year. You know, for example, early this year, since about February or March, getting out of the small cap Russell 2000 stocks and moving more into the blue chip dividend paying type stocks. I commented in a previous episode. If you haven't heard that, you might want to go back and listen in. And I think I might have also written about it in a blog article over at investablewealth.com. And that's about how these fund managers, they're governed by the prospectus of the fund that they run. And they can't necessarily just go into cash. They may be required to be invested 85-90% in stocks. And so even if they think the market is about to take a plunge, they can't go to cash. They still have to own equity stocks. They still have to own common stock, primarily in the U.S. market. And so what they'll do is they'll go into these blue chip stocks. They'll try and weather the storm in these large, you know, fundamentally sound dividend paying stocks. And that doesn't mean that those stocks won't tumble. Think back just a few years ago to 2008. Those big blue chips, they fell 48% or so, just like everything else. But these fund managers, they're managing billions and billions of dollars. They can't go to cash. They have no other choice. So they just hunker down. They try and surround themselves with a battleship of these big blue chip stocks. And then they want to hit the iceberg or weather the storm. Well, I do think that that's what's been happening probably most of this year for the last 3 or 4 months, especially. But even with that, we are seeing the blue chip stocks take a hit. Today, the S&P 500 was down well over 1%, something like, I think, 1.3%. There was a lot of fluctuation and volatility in today's trading range. The market traded well down in the trading range for today. The S&P 500 had a spread of over 30 points today alone, which is about 1.5% or so, maybe 2%. And it closed near the bottom of that range. And I think it did, I don't have the NASDAQ in front of me, but I think it performed about similar on the NASDAQ as well. So when you see a lot of fluctuation, you see a big decline like that, you see the market or a major index closing in the very bottom of its range, and you see that range breaking resistance. The other thing you want to look at is the volume. And if you look at the trade volume for today, it's been no exception, like it's been throughout the year on these big blowout days when there's a lot of selling, when the price drops precipitously. A lot of investors, they come in and they sell hard. Again, that's why I think we're seeing a rotation out of these stocks by professional investors. Perhaps the people that have recently been buying on the dips are the mom and pop retail investors that are just starting to get into the market. They've been out for the last couple years. They've missed the run up, and as usual, they're late to the party. Well, today, the trade volume on the S&P 500, it was way more than average. The volume was up something like probably, 35, 40% higher than normal. Yesterday was the same. The market was down, about 30 basis points or so, and the volume was well above average. Again, about 30% above average. Those are all warning signs. The worst warning sign of all, though, is that all these major indexes have broken through their 50-day moving average. I've mentioned in previous shows how that 50-day moving average can act as support, and we were watching to see if these indexes could hover around that support and then bounce off the 50-day move, and then bounce off the 50-day average and then move higher to new highs. Well, they have been hovering about around that 50-day moving average these last few trading sessions, but today they did break significantly below it. In fact, I would say on the S&P 500, they're almost at a halfway point in between the 50-day moving average and the 200-day moving average. And the S&P 500 has also broken through support that it had from previous highs back in June. So basically, the last few days have wiped out all the profits that the S&P made over the summer. As I record this, the S&P 500 is trading at 1946. As I say, that's broken support, that's broken through the 50-day moving average. I would guess that if it continues to fall, it's not going to find support again until around 1930, so it could easily drop another, 15 points. And then from there, there's not a whole lot of support until it gets back down to the lows that it hit in August, which are right around 1910. So look for that. Again, the index now is at about 1946. There might be some support at around 1930. If it breaks through that, watch it to potentially drop to around 1909. And what's crucial about that was the low that it hit back in August. If it breaks through that, then it would most likely, and again, this is just my opinion, I'm not giving you a recommendation or any kind of trading forecast, just my opinion, just something I'm seeing by reading off the charts. If it breaks through that low that it made back in August, and that's at about 1909, then look for it to potentially hit that 200-day moving average, which would be right around 1900. And again, that's crucial because we want to see, is it going to hit that 200-day moving average and bounce up? If it does, that could be an opportunity to buy on the dips, to get in as a new entry point. But we have to be very careful because we want to make sure that it doesn't break through that 200-day moving average. Because any time an index breaks through its 200-day moving average, that's a very cautionary sign. Now, I will say, though, there is a lot of support right around that 200-day moving average. And so right around 1850 to 1900 on the S&P 500, there's a huge amount of support there. I would be very surprised if it breaks through that. However, what will be interesting is if it does go that low and it breaks through that, Katy bar the doors, no telling what could happen at that point. So watch those numbers. I'll be coming back in future episodes to kind of gauge these support levels and to see how the market and the S&P 500 in particular, how it's performing. Now, something else I wanted to mention in this episode, and this is because I've received some listener comments about things I've said in recent episodes about people, particularly young adults, that don't have a lot of money. They're making at or below the average household income, which is right around $50,000. And yet some of these people that I've talked to recently or met recently, some listeners out of this show, are very diligent, very determined savers. And although they're at or below average in terms of take-home pay, they have an incredibly high net worth for someone of their age and someone of their income. So I've gotten some comments from listeners, and both pro and con. Some people saying, hey, that can't be true. People can't save that much money. Other people saying, hey, thanks for letting me know this. That inspires me. I want to do that. And then other people coming forward and saying, yep, that is true. That is me. I am doing that. And I just talked to another individual the other day. Now, this person, they're single. They're in their, mid to late 20s. I guess probably later 20s. They've been out of college for around 5 years. And although they have a college degree, they're on the lower end of the pay scale. They're making less than $40,000. I think they're somewhere in the range of, say, right around $37,000, $38,000. So while this person would have a lower than average family household income, and it is an individual, it's not a person that's married or doesn't have children. So from that aspect, you can argue that they're either at or above average, because many people making that $50,000 household income, that's coming from two paycheck families. But in any case, $37,000, $38,000, no matter how you cut that up, that's not a lot of money. But this particular person, they're very similar to some of the other people I described to you. So they're single. They're choosing to rent right now instead of buying a home. They're ignoring the advice they're getting about these are historically low interest rates, this is a good time to buy, blah, 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 right? They're a young person. They're uncertain about exactly where their future is going to take them. They're not married at this point, so they don't have a spouse. They don't have children. All that can have a drastic impact on where you live and how you live. So they're being very wise, and they're renting in areas that are very affordable. They've also reduced their overall consumption. Now, they do enjoy things. I mean, they have their particular hobbies and their interests, the recreation that they told me about. I don't want to go into personal details, but I'll just say this isn't a person that goes to work and comes home and like sleeps in a cave. This is a person that if you saw on the street, you would think they have an above average income and you would think that they lead a pretty interesting social life. Okay, so I'm not talking about a hermit. But this particular person, and again, like many other young people I've been having the fortunate privilege to either meet or to talk to, their net worth is somewhere in the range of about $80,000. $80,000 is well above the average net worth for Americans of all ages. So this person is not even 30. They're making less than $40,000 a year. They've only been in the workforce for around 5 years or so, as far as being out of college. And yet they have a net worth of over $80,000. They drive a used car. They rent. They don't have student loans. They don't have credit card debt. They don't buy anything that they can't pay off in 30 days. They don't take vacations they can't afford. Do you see the pattern here? Exactly. And that's what I'm trying to preach to you. Wealth is a lifestyle. I talk about wealthsteading because I want you to think in terms of homesteading. How can you and your family live your life in a wealthsteading or homesteading type fashion where you're doing things with your life and your career and your hobbies and your interests that are productive, that are enjoyable, but that don't cost you an arm and a leg? They're not based on consumerism. They're based on productivity. They're based on building your wealth. That's the wealthsteading lifestyle. And that's what I hope you're getting from listening to this podcast. Other people are doing it. They're doing it in their 20s. They're doing it in their 30s. You can do it too. If you currently have a net worth that's below average or below what it should be for your age group or your demographic or your income level, then there's only one person that can do something about that, and that's you. And so I encourage you to go out and do something about it because you can. And if you don't, down the road, I don't know if it's going to be 5, 10, 15, 30 years from now, but at some point, if you don't change your lifestyle, you're going to be sorry. Okay, no more preaching. My sermon is done. Let's get to a listener question, and they asked, is investing in the stock market the same thing as gambling? You know, why is it different, if it is? And I'm going to tell you, yes, very much. Investing in the stock market or trading in stocks is significantly different than gambling. But the answer I'm going to give you is not what you think you would normally hear. I'm going to tell you that trading in the stock market, the reason is unlike gambling, because in gambling, you have better odds. And in fact, in gambling, you do have odds. Now, I'm not a big gambler, so my analogies here, they may be a little weak. I don't play cards. I don't play poker and blackjack or dice or roulette or whatever. I don't do it because I'm, you know, necessarily opposed to it on religious grounds or anything. To me, it just always looked like a sucker's game. I knew the casino had things rigged, or even just in a regular card game, you know, the odds were going to be against me. I can't count cards. I'm not that good with those kind of numbers and things and not that observant to be able to figure out how many aces have been dealt for the deck and, you know, all those kind of strategies. That's just not what I do. I'm not good at that. And so I try and avoid things that I'm not good at that cost me money. And so that's why I don't gamble and I don't know much about it. And I have no interest to really learn. But here's what I do know about gambling. Gambling has set odds. If you have a deck, if you have a card deck, a standard deck, it has 52 cards in it. The probability of drawing a particular card from that deck is 1 in 52, because there's 52 cards in that deck. A set of dice, or a die, I guess it's called, a die. When you roll a die, there's 6 numbers on that dice, or on that die. So if you're going to roll a 1 or a 2 or a 3 on any one die, whatever that one number that's going to come up on that individual dice, the odds are 1 in 6 that you're going to get a 1 or a 2 or a 3 or whatever, because, you know, I'm assuming you're rolling one die at this point. Because there's only 6 numbers that can come up. So the same thing would be true of, you know, roulette wheels or different card games you play. Again, if you're playing blackjack or poker or even like a roulette wheel, you can determine the odds. You can count the cards. You can bluff and do these different things that are a little more skill level, but there are certain odds associated with it. You can do things to improve your odds, but at the end of the day, you're still dealing with firm odds. Well, you know what? In the stock market, there are absolutely no odds. Now, that may be a surprise to you because nobody ever tells you that. In fact, they tell you exactly the opposite. They're always acting like there are odds, like they can predict things, or that they can make forecasts based on solid data or algorithms or historical events or whatever. And the bottom line is, They can't. I don't care if they're an economist. I don't care if they're a billionaire investor. I don't care if they're a guy like me that just happened to make it good for himself. Not me, not anybody can accurately predict the odds of an individual index or a stock. Now, we may have indicators we look at. We may use algorithms. We may have program tradings. We may do all these different things to enhance our performance. But be forewarned, there are no odds in the stock market. There are over 300 million people in the United States. There are over 7 or 8 billion people in the world. The interaction, the trading, the wars, the greed, the hate, the human events of all those people, those billions of people, that's what affects the stock market. That's what affects the indexes. That's what affects the performance of Procter & Gamble, of Clorox, of Ford Motor Company, of Tesla. Now, yes, it is true. We can look at historical events. We can look at trends. We can look at human nature. We can look at price-volume ratios, correlate and don't correlate with certain asset groups. We can do all that, but it is only speculation. There are no actual odds that we can use to determine that. And again, it doesn't matter whether you're an economist from Harvard University. No one with a surety can predict the market accurately with specific odds. So in gambling, you have known and determined odds. In the stock market, you don't. In the stock market, you have risk. And I prefer to, rather than call it risk, to call it uncertainty. Because uncertainty is what it says. You cannot be certain about the outcome. If you flip a coin, you know, on average, over time, 50% of the time you're going to get heads, 50% of the time you're going to get tails. If you're a really bad stock trader, you can go out and buy 100 different companies in the S&P 500, and you can have 100 out of 100 failures. There are no odds assuring you specific success. Now again, yes, true, we can look at historical information. We can look at trends. I spend my life doing those things. And overall, I have a pretty good record. I've done well for myself. But I'm also smart enough and not egotistical enough to know that I have no idea what's going to happen when the stock market opens up tomorrow. And again, I want to emphasize, neither does anyone else. So when an expert or someone's trying to tell you that they know that they have insider information, that they have some special algorithm, that they have some special program that they've back-tested, yada, 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 whatever that is, it's BS. It's hype. It's marketing. It may be an out-and-out lie or a scam. So now, having said this, why would any rational person trade stocks or even try to invest in the stock market? Well, the fact of the matter is that if you use prudence, if you use wisdom, if you're a student of the markets and a student of history, and you're not so arrogant to think that you're the smartest man in the room, and by the way, if you get a little bit lucky, then over time, you can have success in the market provided you're investing in stocks and companies that have solid fundamentals and the overall trend of the market or the economy that you're invested in is growing. Now, fortunately, for most of us, we live in the United States, and as bad as things are, we do have an economy that, although it stumbles overall, it does keep growing. We have a transparent, very liquid stock market. We have the ability to go in and purchase shares in reputable companies where we can make a judgment call based on their past performance to try and forecast their future performance. But there are no guarantees. The only guarantee you have is that you're going to encounter risk and uncertainty. So know that. Be aware of that. If you're in the stock market and you're invested in something like the S&P 500 or a major index like that, chances are you're not going to lose everything. But you don't have to look too far back in history to see that over a very short period of time, you could lose 25 to 50% of your savings. So be cautious. Always be aware of that risk and that uncertainty. And I don't want to go off on a tangent here, but I do want to relate my little diatribe here on the stock market not having odds and being full of uncertainty and not being able to be 100% predictable, unlike the odds that you would get in a casino or in a card game, like that you would have in normal gambling. I want to kind of draw the analogy, and this is to get you to think about the government and the economy and the general situation that you live in. Just as there are many people in the financial industry that try and market to you, or people in the media that try and convince you that there is a rhyme or a reason or a predictable way to come up with odds in the stock market. Now, while you're being sold that, be also aware of all the government economists and all the central bankers and all the politicians and all the corporate fascist CEOs that want to try and convince you that those elite people can manipulate the money system, the monetary system, the interest rates, and that they can manage the economy. Well, they can no more accurately manage the economy than you or I can predict the performance of the stock market tomorrow. They cloak their forecasts in these mysterious, robes with all forms of data. Manufacturing data, unemployment data, investor sentiment, all these different things. These economists, these bureaucrats, these politicians, these business leaders, they try and justify their actions with data. And that data, at the end of the day, it's ultimately worthless. That's the difference between a Keynesian economist, a monetarist, even someone that's fairly conservative from like the Chicago School of Economics. All those people are separated from someone that would be more of a laissez-faire, qualitative economist that would be a disciple of Mises, Hayek, or of Austrian economics in particular, the school of Austrian economics, not the country. If there's interest in this, again, let me know down the road. Maybe I'll do some episodes dedicated to Austrian economics and how you can apply that into your own life, not only in form of just building wealth, but to help give you a different worldview or to give you a different paradigm. Because life is exactly like the stock market. There are no odds. It's full of risk and uncertainty. And we should live our lives and prepare accordingly. Now, in our next episode, I'm going to cover the anatomy of a stock trade. I received a lot of questions early on from listeners about getting down in the weeds about trading stocks. I did an episode a little while ago that did talk a lot about what I look for and things like that, but I've avoided specifically doing like a stock trade demo or the actual anatomy of a stock trade because I didn't want it to be too wonkish. I didn't want it to be too numbers-based. I want it to be enjoyable and of interest for the whole audience. But I've been getting more requests to do something like that. I've been thinking about it a long time. So I've been developing a protocol for it that I think I can use, and I'm planning on doing this on the next episode. Without getting too much into numbers or too wonkish or making it boring, I'm going to do a show that presents to you the actual nuts and bolts of doing a stock trade. And then I promise throughout it and specifically at the end, we'll be wrapping up things with some just general, gold nuggets, some jewels of information that you can use whether you have been trading stocks for the last 30 years or whether you've never traded one and don't ever intend to. Like all episodes, no matter what the actual content or the topic of the episode is, I try and pull everything back to those 10 wealth-building principles. I try and use a little garnishing from my own personal history, from people that I know, from human events, to help you be able to apply these things in your life so that you can raise your income, so you can raise your net worth, so you can raise your standard of living, so ultimately you can buy your freedom. You can be that person that you were put on this earth to be. I want to thank all of our loyal listeners, and again, a welcome to all those that might be new to the podcast. If you ever have a question or a comment or something you want to hear me discuss on future shows, you can contact me through wealthsteading.com. I really appreciate those of you that made an effort to go out and review us and to subscribe to the podcast in things like Stitcher or iTunes. If you haven't done that, please go out and do it. It'll help spread the word about this show. The bigger the community gets, ultimately the more feedback I'll get and the better I can make it for everyone. Thank you for listening. Until the next episode when we talk about the anatomy of a stock trade, this is John Pugliano wishing you the very best of returns.